This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually illusion is usually, but in the battle for civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that I expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually illusion is usually, but in the battle for civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that I expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Mr. John Quirk. And Mr. Quirk, of course, teaches at a diplomatic school in Paris. And, of course, he lives alternately between Florida and he has a farm in Normandy. He's written a number of books and articles on the intelligence community, the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA entrance examination, the FBI entrance examination, CIA and drug wars, a 1986 book, Drug Enforcement Agents, Latin America and the News, United Nations, our U.S. National Security Concerns for the Year, New Targets and Goals for National Security, All European Intelligence Services, Foreign Local Police, Cooperation, Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, Banking Secret Havens, and Terror in Latin America. Mr. Quirk is a world traveler. He's in touch with people all throughout the world and in the school for diplomats and retired diplomats. Of course, they teach people about diplomatic protocol and so much more. Mr. Quirk, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thanks, Stan. It's my pleasure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about certainly what you do. Why do diplomats need to go to school?
Well, they need to go to school, and people that are studying diplomacy need to look at other areas of just typical diplomatic studies. In the world we live in today, that diplomats have to know about international trade and finance, national security, terrorism, foreign policy, and international relations, not just the art of diplomacy, which is negotiation.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, you're living in Europe. You probably have somewhat of a different perspective of what's going on in Europe, in the Middle East, and here in the United States. I have a feeling we're entering into a very difficult and dangerous time. What are your thoughts?
Well, we are in an extremely dangerous time. If you look back at President Bush's speech on Axis of Evil, which identified Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Iraq, of course, is off the chessboard, but we actually have more enemies and adversaries. We have to also question some of the reactions of our friends. We have threats from Venezuela. The North Korean bilateral and multilateral talks to end their nuclear program has not made any progress at all. You have the rise of intelligence services in Russia. And, of course, this year, the State Department, the intelligence community, and our policymakers for the first time overtly identified China as our main future adversary.
And of course, how can America alone do all of this? Certainly, you know, we have the greatest military in the world, but we've got some real financial problems, and many people feel that we are spending far beyond our means, and there may well soon be a financial crisis. Are you hearing any rumbles about that in Europe?
No, you know, I'll tell you where we are. I feel that we're such a rich country, such a strong country, and we're getting richer and stronger. The Europeans are going the other way. They just are...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back in just a moment with Mr. John Quirk. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. John Quirk. And Mr. Quirk, I had the opportunity to meet recently. He teaches at a school for diplomats in Paris. He lives in Normandy and in Florida. He's a world traveler. He's written extensively on intelligence and certainly on the intelligence agencies and the FBI entrance examination. He's written probably 20 or 30 articles and books, certainly well qualified to discuss what's happening in the diplomatic and intelligence fields, and I had just simply asked him if he was concerned about what was happening to the United States from a financial point of view with our massive deficits, both trade and domestic, and he said no, that America is such a strong country, and that certainly in Europe the economies there are going the wrong way. So would you like to pick up on that idea?
Yeah, one of the problems that the Europeans have is that they're so socialist that the tax structure is just draining them. And one of the things that they don't understand is that you've got to spend more money in research and development. So you develop a new microchip, you fund a new university. Some of that money is wasted, but in the end, research and development is what fuels the economy of America. In Europe, they have a hard time putting money into research and development because they can't afford to waste any money. And as a result, you have great medical care in Europe, you have great bridges, roads, infrastructure, they have very weak militaries, and the tax structure is unbelievably. Europe, however, is starting gradually to come around to the American point of view. Right after 9/11, Europe was very anti-American. The populations are still anti-American. But even France, Spain, and other countries, especially with the incident of the Danish cartoons, are starting to realize that radical Islamic fundamentalism is a threat to Western civilization. And in the last few weeks, France, Scandinavia, and some of the more liberal countries in Europe are starting to come around to the United States' point of view regarding national security issues.
Well, now, do you foresee a war between the West and radical Islam? Do you foresee a war with Iran sometime in the next year or two?
I think that when you're talking about radical Islam, I think there'll be constant low-intensity conflicts, especially with countries that may be threatened by radical fundamentalism. When it comes to Iran, yes, I see that they do not want to negotiate. They have threatened Israel. They've denied the Holocaust. There is a radical sect there that is influencing the mullahs to...
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. John Quirk. And I had simply asked the question, will there be a war with Iran? And John had replied, yes, there seems to be a very, very radical element that controls the reins of government in Iran. They've certainly denied the Holocaust. They seem to be violently anti-Israel. And Mr. Quirk, I think, really feels that it's a matter not if, but when the war comes with Iran. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, I think it'll be a limited war. I don't think we'll put troops in or invade, or we won't destroy their culture. We don't want to destroy their cities. It'll be a very brief attack on their 450 nuclear facilities. We have the ability to do that almost technologically with new cruise and Tomahawk missiles. The Israelis probably don't have that ability. And as the Iranians get closer to the development of a nuclear weapon, if they don't have it already, I think that the Bush administration will actually receive pressure from Europe, other countries, And I think the Democrats and Republicans will close ranks, and instead of Bush initiating it, they will demand that the president take action against Iran.
Well, but won't this inflame the entire Islamic world against the United States?
Well, it could, but you see, the Iranians are not Arabs. They're Persians. And even though they're Muslims, their brand of Islam, which is mainly Shia, doesn't go very well in all of the other 25 Muslim countries. So if it's over quickly, I don't think we'll give a chance for radical Islam to do anything. The other thing is the Iranians are the ones that are fueling a lot of radical Islamic movements. They fund Hamas, they fund Islamic Jihad, they fund Hezbollah, and their intelligence service is the one that's stirring up a lot of trouble over these Danish cartoons.
I'm sure that they are. On the other hand, doesn't Saudi Arabia actually fund Hamas as well, and certainly much of the anti-Israeli movement within the Palestinians?
I think so, but the thing about the Saudis, they've paid extortion to everybody over the years, including Al-Qaeda and the Madras schools and the Wahhabi sect, and they don't exclusively fund Hamas. They are actually, the Saudis have with their relationship with the Bush family, have actually reached out to the United States and said, if there ever is a war with Iran and oil is interrupted, we will make up the difference. So they're trying to ingratiate themselves back with the United States.
Well, I would think that, especially after 15 of the 19 hijackers just happened to come from Saudi Arabia,
that's correct.
I would think that they would be very, very loath to do anything to antagonize the American people. They might begin looking at who the fellow is behind the mask there.
Right.
Anyway, under any circumstances, when do you think that the war might come, if it does come, with Iran? And, of course, this would have a profound impact, certainly on our currency. Or do you think it would have an impact on the value of our currency throughout the world?
No, I don't think it will have an impact if it's a one-week attack or less. And that's all you probably need to take out these 450 nuclear sites that are spread out through the country. It's most likely going to take place somewhere after the November elections, and maybe towards the end of the Bush administration. The congressional elections this November are very important to the Republican Party. They have some trouble over the port issue. They're hooking the whole policy for all Republican congressmen on national security. So Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the rise of China are all national security issues that have to be addressed. But Iran is probably on the top of the list.
Well, I think there are an awful lot of people in America who are quite incensed that the Bush administration doesn't see anything wrong with turning control of our ports over to a country that's controlled by the government of Dubai.
Well, you know, there's another story to that. Let me explain it, because I do not agree with a lot of the congressional opposition to the Dubai ports. Going back to the old saying, keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. After 9/11, the Bush administration put billions of dollars in the maritime security. The Coast Guard is in 54 countries. We have ISI codes. We do background checks on all the crews of ships all over the world. We inspect containers. We put beepers in them. We've got two or three intelligence agencies that monitor the ports and inspect things that come into the port. And I think it's better to have a relationship with the UAE for intelligence than to push them away. Now, I know people are excited and they said, how could we turn this over to an Arab government? But the UAE, in their port security, has formed many agreements with the American intelligence community so we can detect a weapons of mass destruction that comes in a container. By blocking them and pushing them out, it actually gives a better reason for deployment by a radical group. And I think you'll start to see this as the debate goes on. I mean, Bush did not just do this in an isolated incident, and it's caused a furor. He's losing political capital on it. But I think when members of Congress start to understand the parameters of a small terrorist group trying to deploy a nuclear weapon in a container, they'll understand why the UAE is involved. They're not an enemy. Okay, They're a cooperating country because so much stuff is shipped through the UAE. So that's just my opinion on it.
All right. Well, it's going to be certainly. It is quite an issue, and I think many people are really begin to wonder how dedicated the Bush administration really is to the war on terror. When of course we see them consistently covering for Saudi Arabia and their involvement in the 9/11 attack, and as having censored the various government reports, both the initial Joint Intelligence Committee report and the 9/11 Commission report. And if they're not concealing anything, we have to ask why they wanted to censor this. Are they afraid that Osama bin Laden's going to find out what's going on?
Well, you know, we blame the Saudis, who are, it's a bizarre kind of venal country. But at the same time, you have to blame parts of our intelligence community, because for years we funded and managed the Saudi and Pakistani intelligence services.
You mean the RCIA was working very closely with both Saudi and Pakistani intelligence?
Of course. In terms of the Pakistani intelligence, we dropped the ball there because the head of the Pakistani intelligence service, ISI, we found out was actually helping bin Laden in obtaining weapons of mass destruction. We lost contact with the Pakistanis. Same thing with the Saudis. The Saudis were trained at CIA. Their police officers were trained at the FBI Academy in Quantico. We had great relations. Just before 9/11, they went mute. They didn't tell us what was happening. Their officers probably knew what bin Laden was up to. So there's plenty of blame to go around, not just blaming the Saudis or the Pakistanis. You also have to blame the United States, our intelligence services, that they should have had sources and penetrated both the Saudis and Pakistanis who had liaison relationships with Al-Qaeda.
What you're suggesting then is both the Saudis and the Pakistanis were working with Al-Qaeda?
Oh, yes. Well, I wouldn't say working with it. I would say that they knew they had enough intelligence on what bin Laden was going to do. And I believe the Iraqis also knew what bin Laden was going to do.
All right, fine. Then, what do you think is going to happen as far as Iraq is concerned? Certainly, we've been fighting with, the attack on September 11th over 4 years ago. I mean, the Second World War lasted only a little over 4 years. So, how long is this war going to drag on?
Well, I'm an optimist. You know, people are saying there's going to be a civil war in Iraq between the Sunni and the Shiites and the Kurds. But there's a lot of positive things happening in Iraq. We've spent billions there. Democracy is gradually starting to take hold. Security is increasing on the borders. The Syrians have backed off quite a bit. Some of our other people that were shipping guns to the insurgents have backed off. The real problem in Iraq is between the Sunni and the Shia. If we can't get those two people to work together, there could be a civil war. But we are doing everything on all levels, military, technological levels, training of police, diplomacy, training their diplomats to make sure it works.
Well, I've never understood why it was that when we went into Iraq, and certainly there was an attack society at that time, certainly it was corrupt, it was headed by a corrupt man, but why we dissolved the Iraqi army, and why we dissolved the Iraqi police force and the Iraqi civil service, and laid the base for the chaos that ultimately developed. It would have seemed to be much better to have tried to use the existing social structure, and then gradually, if there were bad people in that, to have gotten rid of them, rather than just sort of disband everything.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think you put your finger on it. We should not have disbanded the Iraqi army. We disbanded it because it was full of Sunnis. And I've worked with Sunnis, Iraqis, when I was in France. I went overseas 2 days after 9/11, and I worked on Iraqi projects. And the Sunnis are very well educated. They wanted to be rehabilitated, but we at that time just could not trust them. So we decided, don't let any of them come in the army. Don't let any of them stay in the army. It's better to disband the whole army because the Ba'ath Party and the Sunnis ran the whole thing. So it's kind of hindsight looking at it, but I think Paul Bremer refers in his book that it was probably a mistake. So I don't know. We are rebuilding the army, and it's going pretty well. And, you know, it's one of these things that we did make a mistake. But as I said, a lot of progress is being made in Iraq. You just hear about the negative things, the bombings.
I was just reading an article in the New York Times about a general who was assigned the job of rebuilding the Iraqi army. An army for a nation of 25 million people. And he said he initially was given 6 people.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they gave him a few more. He was supposed to have 250 to build this massive army, but, well, occasionally they'd have 150 people. They wouldn't be there very long. And he said the Pentagon had this at the bottom of the list of their priorities. It seems that they really weren't that interested. That was the bottom of the priorities. I would have thought that would have been at the top of the priorities that we could begin pulling our troops out whole. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. John Quist, Mr. John Quirk, who, of course, teaches in a school for diplomats over in Paris. And I was just commenting that it was my concern. I would have thought the major priority for the Pentagon would have been to rebuild that Iraqi army that we mistakenly disbanded. And yet that seemed to be at the bottom of the priorities, at least according to the American general who was assigned the task of rebuilding the Iraqi army.
Well, don't forget the Shia were persecuted for over 35 years by Saddam Hussein. And they were excluded from most key positions in the army, the diplomatic corps, the business community. So to create an army of Shia who were not in senior positions was a Herculean task. The idea was you couldn't leave members of the Ba'ath Party there because then they'd have access to the weapons. Now, there's a building process going on, but what is happening, most of the insurgents are Sunnis and foreigners, and they want to destroy democracy in America. The Shias are in a key position. They've got to learn everything all over, how to be diplomats, how to be businessmen, how to be military officers. So it's going to be an uphill battle, but I think the United States will succeed in it.
Well, we hear about these death squads over there, where the Shia now, police officers are going out and just indiscriminately killing Sunnis, 20, 30, 50 here, there, and elsewhere. They find the graves of these people we put in power. Is this really true? Is this sort of thing going on?
Yes, it is true. It almost reminds me of what the right-wing death squads were doing in Colombia, killing, you know, drug dealers and killing Marxists. And the Shia, the insurgency in Iraq is now taking on a different kind of life. Instead of attacking Americans, they're trying to attack the Shia to cause a civil war, to cause trouble. So the Shia, they're getting fed up with their mosques being blown up and their businesses being blown up, and they're forming their own paramilitary groups. It's not as exaggerated as people think it is, but it's happening. It could increase if we don't get the Sunni insurgents and the foreigners out of the country. It could increase and it could lead to a civil war. But I think the United States is doing everything it can to head that off.
Well, of course, aren't the Shias, the Shia Muslims in the southern part of Iraq, forming a common alliance now with the Shias in Iran?
Yes, well, when you say forming a common alliance, the Iranians would love to influence them and eventually take over Iraq because the Shia relationship is very, very important. But a lot of that Iranian insurgency has been exaggerated, okay? They have shipped guns, they have stirred up trouble, but the Shia that we are working with in Iraq so far are very loyal to America. What will happen in 10 or 15 years, nobody knows. There may not be a Shia fundamentalist government in Iran, so we don't have to worry about it. So we're in a race. The Iranian Shia like the fact that there was democratic elections because the Shia, backed by the United States in Iraq, have won. They're hoping that if they can stay in power in Iran, they'll have an ally with the Shia. But that's a long way off. It could be anywhere from 7 to 15 years off. And by then, I think fundamentalist Iran will be removed from the chessboard.
All right. Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens, especially after we attack Iran. I'm assuming we will. And I would think that at that point, they would probably be doing everything they could to stir up problems in American-occupied southern Iraq. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. John Gwirkin. He's certainly an expert on what's going on over in Iraq and certainly in Europe and throughout the world because he lives in Paris and Normandy, and though he does have a home certainly in Florida. And I was simply commenting that if we do attack Iran, and I think Mr. Quirk feels that way, and I certainly feel everything I hear from experts around the country ensures us that there's going to be a war with Iran. Of course, everybody thinks it's going to be a very short little war. That's how the First World War got started. It was just going to be a short little war. That's how the Boer War got started. They said everybody would be home by Christmas, but didn't quite work out that way. 100,000 British casualties later, why the troops did come home. But be that as it may, wouldn't the Shias in Iran do everything they could then to try to destabilize southern Iraq and try to destabilize Iraq to retaliate against us?
Well, I think their retaliation plans are probably more sophisticated. They know that they probably are going to receive an attack from the United States or Israel. And what they've done is they've formed terrorist cells in Venezuela, probably Canada and the United States. They have large intelligence operations in France, and I think that, and certainly they're not Iraqis, okay? We did not suffer any Iraqi terrorism in the United States before, during, or after the war with Iraq, okay? But with Iran, it's different. The Iranians know what we're going to do. They're planning for it. I think they're accelerating their nuclear program. They already have very accurate, sophisticated weapons that could hit the Seventh Fleet, London, Paris, and certainly Israel. So I think they would probably retaliate more in Europe and in the United States, and they already have quite a few cadres based in Venezuela, which is very close to the United States.
Well, my understanding is that they recently purchased some long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, I suppose, 6,000, 8,000 miles. Is there any truth to that?
Well, nobody really knows. What we do know is back as early as 2001 that the North Koreans, according to CIA reports, were shipping very sophisticated missile parts in trade to fund the North Korean weapons program. But knowing what the Koreans have, they don't have the ability to barely hit Japan. So it's unlikely that they would have a missile that could go more than, I would say, 3,000 kilometers. Now, Israel is well within that range, and somewhere between Paris and London is in that range. But I doubt if they have anything more sophisticated than that.
Well, I mean, the Paris and London would certainly see those subjected to a nuclear attack. One of the major things, apparently, is the tremendous instability in Pakistan. And certainly my intelligence sources suggest that Musharraf may not be the dictator there for too much long, the military dictator, that within a year, why, this could be taken over by radical Islam. Is there any truth to that? Because
yes, that is on the top of the fear list because, as you know, under the Khan, the Pakistani nuclear engineer, under the Khan, he's the father of the Pakistan nuclear weapons. Pakistan has sophisticated missiles from North Korea and aid from China a long time ago, and that government is very unstable. There's fundamentalists still in the intelligence services, a lot in the military, a lot in the diplomatic corps. They are certainly pro-Bin Laden. They're anti-American. But we have a very strong ally that supplies very good intelligence, and that's India. And a few years ago, when India and Pakistan, if you remember, were ready to go at it, the United States negotiated the settlement. And both countries were threatening to use nuclear weapons against each other over Kashmir and over various elements of what was going on in the war of terrorists. But you're right, that Pakistani government is extremely shaky.
And of course, the thing is, my fear is that if we attack Iran, that it's going to give impetus for the radical Muslims, the members of Muslim Brotherhood or Al Qaeda, talk what you will, in Pakistan to seize control of that government with their nuclear weapons and their sophisticated missiles. That to me is a very, very frightening scenario.
Well, I think the Indians wouldn't put up with that. It's something the United States probably would not be involved with. The Indian government will not put up with a radical Islamic state in Pakistan.
So what will they do with the attack?
They could do a preemptive strike. They've threatened Pakistan before.
Well, of course.
But one thing that's going on now between Pakistan and India that's very positive, they are engaging in daily diplomatic talks. They've opened up different roads. There's a lot of positive signs that are going on. And the Pakistani government, is, with U.S. help, is trying to weed out the radical Islamists in the Pakistani intelligence service and the military.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Mr. John Quirk, and we're talking really about what's going on in the Middle East, and I think as we look and see what's going on there, we see the potential for a very real problems there. And certainly, do you think that we're ever going to be able to win the Muslims back to the point where we're more or less on friendly relations? Certainly, you know, go back 5 years, we were in fairly good relationships with most Muslim countries. I think after 9/11, Muslims throughout the world were very sympathetic with America. What happened to that sympathy?
Well, I think what's happened is there, we still have good relations with Turkey, Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco. We have Algeria is getting very close to the United States. We have special forces troops based there. We help them defeat their terrorist problem down in the southern part of Algeria. Libya has opened up the door, and they've been very, very cooperative. There's American companies and military in Libya. Libya has supplied us with over 60 containers of information. They're in Tennessee now on the Pakistani Iranian nuclear programs. We do have trouble with countries like Sudan and Chad, Somalia and Ethiopia, but we have fairly good relations with today. We may not like them with Saudi Arabia. Our relations with Jordan are good. Yemen, so-so, but Indonesia, so-so, but I think that what we've realized after 9/11 and what Muslim countries have realized is that they must eradicate their own Islamic fundamentalist problem. It's a threat to secular Muslim countries as much as it is to Europe, America, and Western civilization. And I think that their intelligence services and military have the Muslim Brotherhood under control in Egypt. They're rooting out a lot of terrorist groups in Morocco, Tunisia. Libya doesn't have the problems it used to have. Saudi Arabia is still a problem. Turkey has been tough on Islamic fundamentalism, and yet they're an Islamic fundamentalist type of country, but they don't want terror and they don't want trouble. I think the overall populations, the young people in these countries, hate the United States. And they've listened to a lot of propaganda about us. They think, you know, it's a problem of religion insinuating itself into politics. And I think you're going to see more and more religion, Islam, insinuated into governments in the Mideast. And it's up to the Mideast countries.
Hold that thought there for just a minute. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mr. Quirk was simply saying that it is many of the younger people there in the Muslim countries that are embracing this radical form of Islam, and that certainly something's going to have to be done to control that. He was listing, of course, the countries that, you know, are already, of course, are on our side, countries like Turkey, but, of course, if they had a free election tomorrow, the radical Islam would win, wouldn't it?
Yes, well, it did. I mean, it is. It's not radical Islam. It's fundamentalist in Turkey, but they've been very, very secular. You know, I mean, it's not like Hamas, which is a threat, winning a democratic election, or even Hugo Chavez, who is an evil person that's won a democratic election. So this is another problem the United States has to confront. How do you deal with radical people and radical organizations that win democratically. This is a new challenge for America.
Well, of course, in Turkey, they may hold elections, but the military is in control. They can get all the people elected they want to, but the military, I mean, the parliament is totally under the control of the radical Islam, but the military government maintains control. Just the same thing in Algeria. We talk about democracy, but we really wouldn't want a majority vote, rule in any of those countries, would we?
Well, you know, no. I mean, it's not our place in certain countries to criticize the countries if they're not democratic. In the case of Turkey, they're very pro-American. We can only hope that whether it's 20 or 50 years that they move towards democracy. It's the same thing in Algeria. You know, you have a very strong, powerful country that's an important country, it's in North Africa, but it's an important Islamic country. We want them to be pro-U.S., and hopefully they will change. But it's a feature of the Mideast. You have no democratic countries. Morocco's moving towards democracy, but very, very slow. So it's a conundrum for the United States. It's a problem.
Didn't they kill about a million people in Algeria, putting down those people who won the democratic election, and we didn't like the democratic results, so they killed a million people?
Well, I don't know if it was a million people. I've seen figures of 150,000 to 200,000, but most of those people were directed by fundamentalist cells and had relations with Salafists in the southern Algeria, and they were linked to Al-Qaeda, and the government was fighting them for probably 15 years. So I wouldn't say those people that were defeated were embracing democracy. They were terrorists.
I see. But I thought they had elections there, and the fundamentalists won, and then they just sort of negated the results of the election.
Yeah, they won in certain local elections.
I see.
They didn't win in the national elections. The national elections in Algeria, which, I mean, are controlled by the military and the nomenclature, the apparatchiks there that have been in power since Algeria became independent in the late 50s, it will never give up power, at least in the next few years. It's really a one-party system.
Okay, well, now what about Venezuela? Because I know you feel very close to what's happening there. And here we have Hugo Chavez, who is obviously a Marxist, who hates America, and he won, at least apparently, a democratic election. What are we going to do about that? Because he actually has a liaison with Al-Qaeda, doesn't he? And isn't he working with the Iranian mullahs?
Yes, he is actually our biggest national security threat. It's not North Korea. It's not Iran. It's Venezuela. I lived there many years, and, you know, FARC operates there, the Colombian Marxist guerrillas. The Cubans control the Venezuelan military, political campaigns, and their intelligence services. They work against us here. The Venezuelan government works against us here. They're funding these Bolivarian movements in Oregon and Washington and Virginia, as well as Panama and Nicaragua. The Chinese are building two megaports and an oil pipeline. But the big problem is not only the fact that he's embraced Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah operates there. Hamas was there last week. They plan to set up an office. Is that he's invited Iranian nuclear physicists, engineers into the IVIC facility. This is a Venezuelan nuclear facility. The other problem is you're dealing with a man that doesn't believe in traditional foreign policy, okay? He is labeled a Marxist. I doubt if he's ever read a book on Marx. You know, he listens to lectures by his mentor, Fidel Castro, and he's trying to build a leftist movement all over Latin America. That is a problem in itself. The biggest problem, he really believes that a small group of terrorists based somewhere in Latin America can deploy a nuclear weapon in America and destroy us.
Now, my understanding is that that Lula there in Lulu, whatever his name is,
Lula.
In Brazil, they're actually going to start enriching uranium here within the next few months or years.
Yes, well, they've talked about it with Brazil, Argentina. The Venezuelans are already enriching uranium for the Iranians. And the Iranians are moving more and more into Venezuela. They see Venezuela as our soft underbelly. And the American embassy and our attachés are under 24-hour surveillance. Chavez has moved to make the country more of a Marxist country. And it's unbelievably ironic because we buy 14.8% of our oil from Venezuela, and we're paying him to fund all these things against us. The big problem with Chavez is that, like Hitler, he's on a schedule. Okay, Hitler, if you look back at history and you say, well, why didn't Hitler wait longer before he invaded Czechoslovakia and started the war in Poland and started to decimate the Jews of Europe? Why didn't he wait five more years until he had more sophisticated weapons? Okay, well, he was on a time clock. He was under pressure to do something to take over the world. Chavez is on a time clock with one goal, to see the United States destroyed. That's how sick he is and how evil. Now, he was democratically elected, okay? Now, there's no doubt about that. There was some fraud, but the majority of the poor voted for him. The majority of the middle class and the wealthy in Venezuela, who haven't fled there, we have about 200,000 of them in the United States, maybe more, they just abstained. They just were completely apathetic about democracy. And there was tremendous corruption before Chavez got in. The corruption under the capitalist governments were the catalyst to a man like Chavez getting elected and becoming president and dismantling democracy. Now, recently, he's bought $3 billion worth of Russian equipment. He bought millions of American equipment we had sold to the Spanish, defensive equipment. And he's acting like America is going to invade him, when in fact what he's doing is giving sustenance and aid to terrorist groups, Arab terrorist groups that are based in Venezuela.
And I think that's so important for our listeners to know that there are Arab terrorist groups based in Venezuela, and certainly this would be a wonderful area for them to stage, bringing nuclear weapons into the United States across our unguarded southern border.
That is our biggest threat, Stan. The biggest threat is from Venezuela, not Iran, not North Korea. Al-Qaeda trains on the Isle of Margarita. Hezbollah's there, Hamas. And this is interesting, all the bad actors, FARC, the Colombian terrorists, the Chinese for some reason, and I think it's Hezbollah, and elements of Al-Qaeda, although they don't wear name bands that say Al-Qaeda, have just opened up a liaison office at the Euro building in downtown Caracas. And of course, the Cuban Intelligence Service, which is first class, protects them. They've taught Chavez great counterintelligence against the American services. They've put out lots of disinformation, which we've investigated and found out not to be true. But the one area that they haven't put disinformation out is, why are the Iranians at the IVIC nuclear facility in Caracas?
And I think that's a very good question. I don't think the average American has any semblance, any idea at all. It's a lot closer to lob a missile into the United States from Venezuela than it is from Iran.
We receive thousands of containers every day from Venezuela, the ports of Maracaibo and LaGuardia in Miami, in Jacksonville, Florida, and other places. Very few are inspected. And this will give you a little interesting note, a piece of intelligence. About 3 weeks ago, the Pentagon established a new department. It's a forensic atomic or nuclear department. And what it is, basically, they're hiring people that if a nuclear bomb goes off in America, they run out and pick up pieces of what's left and try to trace it back to where it really came. What that department really is, it's warning countries like Venezuela that if you think you can covertly help a terrorist group deploy a nuclear weapon in the United States, you will still face retaliation. And this is one of Chavez's goals. He believes that if he covertly helps a terrorist group the United States would never retaliate against a democracy like Venezuela, who've been our friends for many years. But I advise he is the biggest national security threat that we have.
Well, of course, the other thing, of course, is this almost irrational individual who leads Iran today, and I know that you've looked into this secret society, the so-called 12ers group, that seem to be wanting to provoke a war. I mean, this is the most irrational thing I've ever heard, and yet they believe if they can bring chaos to the world, that they'll be able to bring the return of the Mahdi.
Yes, that's very much on the top of the Iranian list. Now, no one really knows. Our intelligence isn't that good. Nobody knows how much influence they have on the ruling party in Iran. They have cadres in the military, the intelligence services. But, you know, the Iranians are pretty smart people. They've had a Persian culture for thousands of years, and they do not want it destroyed by an Israeli nuclear attack or an American nuclear attack or even a conventional attack. But again, you have religion, you know, and whether it's fundamentalists that are Christians or fundamentalist Hasidim Lubavitchers that influence the Israeli government, or whether it's these Mahdi, you know, people, the doomsday sect, you have more and more religion influencing political decision-making, and so it's very scary.
Well, I think one of the things is the remarks of the president of Iran, which are totally irrational. We should wipe Israel off the face of the map. Israel, you know, the Holocaust didn't happen. We ought to wrap Israel up and send it off to Europe. None of this makes sense. These are not the words of a rational man. These are the words of a man who is doing everything he can to provoke an Israeli attack on his country so that, of course, they could retaliate in like form. I mean, we're living in a world where we have military leaders and government leaders who are really quite mad and irrational. And I would say that the leader of Iran and the leader of Venezuela and in many other countries throughout the world are not looking at the world from a rational point of view.
No, nor, and add North Korea to that. So, yes, and it's very difficult to penetrate these societies, to have human intelligence on the ground. Our technical services like the NSA, the National Reconnaissance Office, do a very good job. I live, as you know, in France, and I'm in touch with the Israeli opposition, who have probably been penetrated by Iranian intelligence. And they have a different culture, and they have a different goal of the world. And the United States, not Europe, but the United States is one of the only countries that has the will to stop them.
Well, what's going to happen in Israel now that now we have Hamas has taken over Palestine, and of course these people are totally irrational. They have one goal, and that's the destruction of Israel.
Yes.
Are we going to let that happen? What's going to happen?
No, and I don't think the Israelis are going to let it happen. They've been very quiet about what has happened in Iran. They are, I would say, in somewhat shock about Hamas. They've cut off their funding. I don't think, you know, Hamas may play some games over the next 24 months that they want to negotiate, but I don't think the average Israeli sees peace in the near future. And I don't think you can have peace until Syria and Iran are removed from the chessboard. You can't have peace between the Palestinians because Iran funds part of Hamas and Hezbollah, two terrorist organizations, until Iran changes the regime and Syria. And I think there's a potential for the removal of both of those regimes without the nuclear option and without a massive war.
But
maybe,
course,
I'm wrong.
What about the relationship between Iran and China? China has developed a very close relationship with Iran because they want their oil, and certainly Russia seems to be doing everything they can to supply, for instance, Iran with aircraft missiles that can be used to take down our planes. It almost looks like we're preparing for a massive war there, and both Russia and China are going to be helping Iran.
Well, you know what I call it? I call it the four C's, the letter C. With adversaries and allies in today's world, we have cooperation, we have competition on certain issues, and we have crisis and conflict. In terms of Russia is dismantling democracy. Old KGB runs most of the local provincial governments, thanks to Putin. Putin has two sources of revenue, energy to Europe, which he can use as an extortionate form of national security policy, and they sell arms to everybody. Our big future threat is China, and China has not helped us with the recent negotiations with North Korea. We thought they would help. They have not. China's ultimate foreign policy goal is to push the United States out of the Pacific, and we're not going. They are expanding all their shipping lanes and port facilities in the Caribbean and Latin America. And then the United States did something this year which kind of solidified the Chinese against America. For the first time, the United States came together, intelligence community, State Department, military, lobby groups, and they said, China is an enemy. They are an adversary. Even though they're buying our products, they're paying us, they're developing a market economy, they are throwing more and more of their resources into missile development, which in 2 years can hit California. They're funding a Blue Water Navy. They have some very, very strange behavior with the Muslim world. And they are reaching out all over the world to dominate us economically.
But then why are we lending them massive amounts of money? And why are American corporations going in and building up their military potential? And why is the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the Agency for International Development giving them massive loans for all things to build a nuclear power plant? Why are we building up the best enemy money could buy?
Well, we lost the technology battle with the Chinese. During the Cold War with the Russians, American companies did not go into Russia to set up businesses, okay? Walmart wasn't doing things in Russia. We've lost the technology transfer. They are an economic juggernaut we will never be able to stop.
Well, let's hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with John Quirk. And what you're hearing, ladies and gentlemen, is very, very important. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got three more minutes with John Quirk. And so what message would you like to leave with our listeners today? Because I think we've covered the world, and it looks to me like we are sitting really on the verge of some very serious things.
Well, I'm an optimist. I think the United States is moving back into a multilateral diplomatic position. I think Europe is going to ally with us. The goals, eventually maybe Russia will come back with us to fight fundamentalist terrorists around the world. I think we have to keep negotiating with the Chinese, hope that they democratize, and it doesn't look like they are democratizing. And unfortunately, I mean, national security, I teach a course on national security, and I said national security starts domestically. We have to help our own people, our minorities, our health care, our own economy, as you've alluded to, and so on. But right now, the best thing we can do, and people don't like to hear this, is we have to have a strong military, a strong technology, and a strong missile defense, and a strong intelligence community. Because we have people out there that want to destroy our religion, our civilization, and they're jealous of our lifestyles. And until that goes away, you cannot beat your weapons into plowshares. And I keep going back, and I thank God so much for Ronald Reagan, because he saw this 25 years ago. He saw the rise of China. He saw terrorism. And I think we'll come through it all. And I think that we are going to form new alliances. We're going to keep negotiating diplomatically. Maybe we have to give more aid, like a Marshall Aid plan to the Mideast, who knows. But right now, the main thing we have to do is keep weapons of mass destruction out of this country. And it's a tremendous challenge when you have a lot of bad actors like Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and terrorists that want to take us down.
And I think that really is a very, very real possibility. I think the average American has never thought of America coming under direct attack. We saw the 9/11, but you know that was just an aberration. But I really share your concern for the use of weapons of mass destruction from right here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is the one area that the Bush administration hasn't sold the public on, that there is a real possibility of a nuclear weapon being deployed here. What you're going to start to see now is you're going to start to see more articles about this, and this is the way the articles are going to go. It's just a matter of time before it happens.
Hey, we're out of time, but I want to thank you very much, and I do hope maybe we can get you onto one of our other programs before you go back.
My pleasure.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, while we were talking there, Mr. Quirk was just saying he is certain that we are going to see weapons of mass destruction. It's not a matter of if, it's when they're going to hit the United States. And I would simply ask, if this is a real threat, and I believe it is, why is it the Bush administration steadfastly refuses to buy the weapons that would save the lives of millions of Americans if there was a nuclear attack on America? This was beautifully brought out on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, and if you'd like to see that article, we could make you a copy of it. They will not, absolutely will not do anything to save the lives of millions of Americans. So much of what's going on really doesn't make sense unless there is another factor. There's an X factor. I'd studied what was going on in America for 20 years before I stumbled across the X factor, a book called The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, and we still carry it. And that, of course, eventually led to my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and, of course, to the video we put together, the new video that we're offering now. Actually, it's in DVD form, called The Secret History of America's Beginning, The New Atlantis. The Secret History of America's Beginning, The New Atlantis. It's put together by our good friend Chris Pinto, who will be our guest tomorrow evening for 2 hours. And it goes into the background, the fact that there really are secret societies. You'll see the Rosicrucian Temple over in San Jose, just across the hills from where I live, and the Center for Psychological Research there in Southern California. And there really is so much going on today. And there really are secret societies, and they have a plan to plunge the world into chaos. And there's even a branch of this over in Iran, and the president of Iran is part and parcel of this, as are the mullahs over there. And they're called the Twelvers. If you want to know more about them, we'll be glad to send you an article, the Arnold de Borgrave article. You need to get the DVD, The Secret History of America's Beginning. You need to get my my video. It's called Iraq, the Untold Story, and it comes with a syllabus. You need to get my DVD or video, Planned Population Reduction. And all of these things are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I do hope many of you will want to get my pamphlets. There are three of them. They're only $9.95 for all three, called The Occult Hierarchy. We'll give you the background of these organizations and the secret societies, which have always been here, and, of course, interlocked throughout the world and the governments of the world, and they have a different agenda. They want another cataclysmic war, and out of that, they hope, of course, will come the New World Order and the New World Religion. Of course, the Jews wait for the return of their Messiah. The Muslims wait for the return of the Mahdi. The Hindus wait for the return of Maitreya. We wait for the return of Jesus Christ. But Jesus Christ, I'm sure, is not going to come until, of course, the man of sin has been exposed. And I believe we are moving rapidly towards that situation today. We live in a utopian society, but I fear the utopia that we live in may soon become a nightmare. Our plea with you is get informed. Help us educate the American people. There is no way this is going to be turned back unless there is a massive revival in America and the American people turn back to God. But I don't see much evidence of it, and I certainly don't hear this message coming from the leaders of this country who just say, oh, we've got to follow the administration. We have a Christian administration that treats everybody well, and it's all those wicked Muslims, and yet we're leaving our southern border open. We are specifically not doing anything at all to prepare our people for the possibility of a nuclear attack, nor getting the medicine that would save millions of lives. And, of course, you'll want to get our latest newsletters. We just go down the list of all the unexplainable things that are happening today that suggest that maybe the war on terrorism is not what we think it is. I mean, why would we have disbanded the Iraqi army's police force and civil service over there and created the chaos so that we couldn't bring our men home. Ladies and gentlemen, our number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty.